Tonight we will examine one central assumption about the nature of women, that it is only natural and right that they be wives and mothers, and indeed that there is something unnatural or unfeminine about any woman who is not or does not intend to be both a wife and mother. The basis of this assumption lies in the fact that indeed most women do become both wives and mothers in our society and times, as well as in other cultures and times. But it is a long way indeed from the observation that this is the way things are to this is the way they indeed must be. I have not recently read any better description of this kind of fallacy of thinking than the analogy of Shaw, which is part of the reading you were given for tonight. And I would like to begin with a quote from part of that article. "If we have come to think of the nursery and kitchen as the natural sphere of a woman, we have done so exactly as English children come to think that a cage is the natural sphere of a parrot, because they have never seen one anywhere else. No doubt there are Philistine parrots who agree with their owners that it is better to be in a cage than out, so long as there is plenty of hemp seed and Indian corn there. There may even be idealistic parrots who persuade themselves that the mission of the parrot is to minister to the happiness of a private family by whistling and saying Pretty Polly, and that it is in the sacrifice of its liberty to this altruistic pursuit that a true parrot finds the supreme satisfaction of its soul. I will not go so far as to affirm that there are theological parrots who are convinced that imprisonment is the will of God because it is unpleasant. But I am confident there are rationalist parrots who can demonstrate that it would be a cruel kindness to let a parrot out to fall a prey to cats, or at least to forget its natural accomplishments and coarsen its naturally delicate fibers in the unprotected struggle for existence." What effect has this assumption had on the psychological thinking about the nature of women? This thinking, of course, being done primarily by men. I have chosen to concentrate for part of this lecture on the life and thinking of Freud as a particularly good example of how this assumption, that is, what is usual is also normal or right, can influence scientific thinking. To some extent, flogging Freud is much like flogging a dead horse. Freud has been worked over by just about every writer in the women's movement. Kate Smith's job is particularly good if you're interested, and by many male and female writers outside the women's movement. However, there are two reasons why I feel it is still necessary to deal with Freud's ideas about women. The first is that Freud, as a famous thinker, had an extremely strong influence on our thinking. Much of his theory of psychosexual development has filtered into popular works on psychoanalysis and into some popular child-rearing literature. Even more than the specifics of his theory, which we will discuss below, his general support of the notion that the status quo is a biologically determined necessity has been very influential. It is true that Freud's attitudes were no different from many other men of his time, but Freud was no ordinary man. For many years, his theory of femininity was the only psychological theory on the subject, and has probably had more influence than even Freud intended it to have. The second reason that at least a brief review of Freud's theories about women is necessary is that they have been and continue to be used in the therapy setting. Again, this is not so true of Freud's specific ideas about psychosexual development as it is about his idea that the norm is normal. The number of women who have gone to male therapists because of dissatisfactions with their lives, only to be told that it is them and not society that is at fault, frightens me. The cure is always to adjust, to fulfill oneself in the only possible way, being a good wife and mother. Let us deal first with Freud's cultural views on the role of women. Freud was, to put it bluntly, a chauvinist. To put it in a slightly more complimentary way, he was completely bound by the cultural thinking of his time when it came to the issue of women. Freud was certainly not alone in his views of male superiority, but there were other men who, under the influence of the same culture, deviated radically from the traditional views of Victorian society. One of these was John Stuart Mill. Freud was a great admirer of Mill's and even translated some of his works into German. However, he found Mill, who in every other way was so brilliant, to be absurd in his ideas about women. To Mill's statement that a married woman should earn as much as her husband, Freud responds, "That is altogether a point with Mill where one simply cannot find him human. It is really a stillborn thought to send women into the struggle for existence exactly as men. If, for instance, I imagined my sweet, gentle girl as a competitor, it would only end in my telling her that I am fond of her and I implore her to withdraw from the strife into the calm, uncompetitive activity of my home. I believe that all reforming in law and education would break down in front of the fact that, long before the age at which a man can earn a position in society, nature has determined women's destiny through beauty, charm, and sweetness." One does sense in this statement the voice of Shaw's rationalist parrot. Nor did Freud's views on the subject of women change. Some 50 years after writing the above statement, Freud responded to the question of equality between partners in marriage as follows: "That is a practical impossibility. There must be inequality, and the superiority of the man is the lesser of two evils." Freud's relationship with his wife also reflected how strongly he held a view of male superiority. Before they were married, Freud was a most passionate and jealous lover. Martha was his and his alone. Not only was she forbidden to even see other men, but Freud required that she address a former suitor of hers as Mr. Meyer and never by his first name. Freud's jealousy also included Martha's family. The following description is quoted from a biography of Freud by Jones. "He demanded from her that she should simply not be able to criticize her mother and brother objectively and abandon their foolish superstitions, all of which she did, but that she had to withdraw all affection from them. This on the grounds that they were his enemies, so that she should share his hatred of them." After marriage, there was an abrupt change in Freud's relationship with his wife. The conquest had been made, his manliness proven, and his pride satisfied. He still assumed complete control of her life, but now it involved not adoration and wooing, but simply the assumption that a wife must be an unconditionally devoted partner and mother, caring only for her husband's and children's needs, and only secondarily for herself. How much Freud took his wife for granted is reflected in how little time he chose to spend with her. She seldom accompanied him on vacations. Freud wrote very little about her and his relationship with her in all his attempts at auto-analyzing. Indeed, Freud set aside a special time each week to be with his mother, but there was no comparable time for his wife. At the dinner table, he would often bring some antique he had recently purchased to the table and place it in front of him as a companion during the meal. Martha Freud was, in Shaw's terms, a truly self-sacrificing woman, and for this she was not loved but taken for granted. Turning to Freud's theoretical views, it is only fair to him to point out that he could be frank about his own lack of understanding. As he once said late in his life, "The great question that has never been answered, and which I have not been able to answer, despite my 30 years of research into the feminine soul, is what does a woman want?" Unfortunately, he was seldom so humble in his writing about women. How did Freud think of women? Primarily as inferior, castrated men. All of one's personality is based on sexual drives and sexual equipment. The girl's clitoris is clearly inferior to the boy's penis, and this is indeed the central factor in the development of sex differences. I will give you, as simply as I can, the basics of the development of both sexes. First, the male, since it was, of course, for Freud, the standard by which all female development must be compared. Boys as well as girls formed their first close emotional attachment to the mother. By the time the boy enters the phallic stage — this stage, by the way, has the same name for both boys and girls — At 4 or 5 years of age, he desires the mother sexually. This is the beginning of what Freud called the Oedipus complex. However, the boy's father is seen as an enemy in this situation, and the boy comes to fear that his father will castrate him for these terrible wishes. This fear of castration is so strong that the boy suppresses his wishes to impregnate his mother and identifies with the feared father, thus decisively resolving the Oedipal crisis. Through this transfer of his affection from the mother to the father, he incorporates the father's morality, which, as we shall see later, is stronger than the mother's, and develops a superego. The superego, in psychoanalytic terms, has two parts. One is the familiar conscience, or awareness of guilt when we have done something wrong. The other is the ego ideal, which is the internalized and idealized image of one's parent, which serves as a model for oneself. Once the boy has successfully identified with the father, he is, according to Freud, safe on his way to a full, normal, masculine development. Turning now to the girl. If you found the story of the boy's development rather dramatic, the following may seem terrifying. Indeed, Freud's description of the early development of children, if considered literally, becomes even more horrifying than the most traumatic of soap operas. In the phallic stage, the girl discovers that she does not have a penis, and from this point on, her life is never the same. She is immediately envious of the boy's obviously superior equipment. In fact, so envious that the rest of her life is spent in a search for this fantastic organ. Upon discovery that she lacks what Freud refers to as the only proper genital organ, she assumes that she once had one, but has been castrated, and blames her mother rather than her father for doing this terrible thing to her. Therefore, she rejects her mother and turns to her father for the desired penis. But finding she cannot acquire a penis from him, she settles for second best and wishes he would impregnate her and give her a child which will serve as a penis substitute. If she is to develop normally, the girl will transfer this desire to be given a child from her father to her husband. And of course, a male child who brings with him the longed-for penis is more desired than a female child. However, even if she does successfully accomplish this transition, she is never fully satisfied and is doomed to live forever in the quest of an unattainable penis. Freud observed that not all women take the normal route to attempt to attain a penis, i.e. having a child. Some of them have such strong penis envy that they actually try to castrate men by competing with them in the real world. To Freud, this not only represents an extreme level of penis envy, but also an abnormal course of development and a complete distortion of normal femininity. The boy's superego results from a decisive Oedipal crisis, fear of castration, and the resolution of it, identification with the father. The girl never really has a decisive crisis, since she has already been castrated and never manages to resolve completely these feelings. This results in a weak superego and in women, and in Freud's judgment that women are less moral than men. It is a credit to Freud's genius that, by and large, his observations of Victorian women were accurate. What broke down was his interpretation of them. Young girls do envy boys. Many more girls than boys, when asked, will say they would like to change their sex if they could. When a girl sees her brother receiving preferential treatment from their parents, she must devise some explanation for this. It is probably a lot less threatening for her to think that the reason he has a better deal in the world is because he has a penis, rather than because he is more loved, brighter, or in some way more worthy than she. But the envy of the boy is not of his penis per se, but rather the advantages that penis seems to bring him. Freud's evidence that women have a weaker superego is based on his observation that women evaluate themselves in terms of the reactions of others to them rather than by some absolute internalized standard. These observations were true of Victorian women and to some extent are true of women today. But it has nothing to do with diffuse Oedipal crises, nor even superegos. but rather with how women are taught to think of themselves. Victorian women were, as Freud described them, by and large passive, masochistic, and narcissistic. However, psychologists have noted that these personality characteristics are relatively common in oppressed peoples in other societies. Indeed, for the oppressor to argue, as Freud did, that the oppressed innately like the pain inflicted on them, relieves any feelings of guilt or doubt about the state of the world. What happened was that Freud took these observations and gave them a completely anatomical basis, ignoring all possible psychological and cultural explanations. I would hypothesize that he came up with the explanations he did because of a very strong need to see men as innately superior to women and thereby justify the patriarchal structure of society. Erich Fromm sums this view up nicely. To look at women as castrated men with no genuine sexuality of their own, always jealous of men, with a weakly developed superego, vain and unreliable, all of this is an only slightly rationalized version of the patriarchal prejudices of his time. But to only criticize Freud is not enough. Freud was after an answer to a very important question. What is femininity, and how do children learn about sex roles and sex differences? Unfortunately, very few people other than Freud have even attempted to answer this question, and we will only be able to begin tonight. There are two areas I would like to develop in an attempt to look at the socialization of children. One of these areas involves looking at the notions and attitudes children and adults have about sex differences. The other area concerns what actual behavior differences of young children are, and to what degree these reflect the prevailing attitude of older children and adults as to what natural sex differences are. Looking first at the attitudes of children in Canada toward sex differences, there is useful information in a special report of the status of women concerning sex role images in children. You have been given copies of part of that questionnaire, it's the long sheet, that was given to the children. The measure the researchers used was called sex role differentiation, or because sociologists and psychologists always abbreviate SRD for short. Basically, sex role differentiation is the degree to which a person thinks of the sexes as highly differentiated or as very different from each other. Thus, a child with high sex role differentiation score thinks of boys and girls as being very different, while one with low sex role differentiation scores thinks of boys and girls as being very similar. If you look at the top of the first page, which is labeled Booklet 1, Part 1, you will be able to see how these scores were arrived at. Items 1 through 12 are traits of children that are used as descriptions. What the children were asked to do was to rate how true each of the traits were of boys and girls their own age. This is what the numbers 1 through 7 are for. Opposite each of the traits are 4. Thus, if a child thought tough was very true of boys his or her own age, number 7 would be circled in the column boys your own age. If the same child thought that girls were not very tough, he or she would circle number 1 under the column girls your own age. A child who responded in this way would be said to think of the sexes as very differentiated. Note that it isn't necessary that the child always rate boys higher than girls, only that he or she rate boys and girls very different from each other with respect to the same trait. Continuing on down, I'll just go through them briefly. Items 13 through 24 describe typical actions or behaviors of children. Items 25 through 36 were designed to measure children's attitudes toward jobs that people do. And in part 2, which is at the bottom of that page, items 57 through 64 were answered in a different way, as you can see. These items were designed to measure the attitudes of children towards women's role in society, whether it was, quote, traditional, a word the authors use to describe the attitude that a woman's only place is in the home, or, quote, modern, a word the authors use to describe the attitude that men and women should share equally in the home and outside world. In addition to attitudes the children have about sex differences, the authors were interested in how the children perceived the roles of their parents and in what relationship might hold between how the children pictured their parents and how they perceived sex differences in society. I think it's on the second page at the top, you see, thing starts booklet two, part one. Items 1 through 17 reflect how the children perceive the way their parents divide family responsibilities and chores. Items 18 through 27 deal with who in the family punishes the children and in what situations. Items 28 through 34 reflect how parents differ in having fun and doing things with the child. And items 35 through 41 reflect which parent, in the child's eyes, has the most power in the home in a number of different situations. There were other parts to the questionnaire which you don't have. These included items about religious attitudes, parents' education, occupation, attitudes toward authority. In addition, the children's parents were also asked to fill out a questionnaire about their attitudes and behaviors. About 7,500 Canadian children filled out the questionnaire. They varied in age between 10 and 16 years. Both French and English-speaking samples were included, the English-speaking children coming primarily from Ontario. Children living in both urban and rural areas were included, as well as children from different socioeconomic backgrounds. There were many results reported by the authors. Because of time limitations, I have chosen to emphasize only a few of these that I find the most interesting. One of the most significant, I feel, is that boys at all ages and in both language groups received higher SRD scores than girls. This means that boys describe the sexes as being very different, while girls are much more likely to see them as very similar. What do these results mean? It might be that they reflect a greater pressure on boys to reject all that is feminine and sissy than on girls to reject all that is masculine. It may also reflect the fact that boys have for a longer time been pressured to give up sissy and feminine behaviors and ideas, whereas girls between 10 and 16, while they have experienced similar pressure to give up masculine behaviors and ideas, these pressures have not been so strong until very recently in their lives. I will go into this idea in more detail later. For now, the data make it look like girls are more willing to give up traditional ideas about what is right for each sex than boys are, and to think of the sexes as more equal, probably because girls have more to gain by doing so. Some of the relationships between parents' ideas and children's sexual ideas are interesting. Perhaps the most interesting is that while French-speaking parents and lower socioeconomic status parents had more traditional ideas about the sexes, their children were different. French-speaking children had less traditional ideas, lower SRD scores, about the sexes than did English-speaking children. There were no differences in ideas about the sexes among children of different social classes. Perhaps this indicates that the same culture can have different effects on different generations, or that different generations are responding to different aspects of the culture. Turning, however, not to what parents said they thought and did, which the above questionnaire measured, but to how the children perceived their parents, the relationships are clearer. Children who perceive their parents as unequal in who disciplines them in certain situations, children who perceive their parents as sharing unequally in playing and having fun with them, and children who perceived one parent as having more power than the other in certain situations, all had higher SRD scores. Thus, children who see parents as sharing the responsibility and power in the family equally see the sexes as more similar than children who see the parents dividing up the responsibility and power unequally. This gives us some information about how children come to think about appropriate sexual behaviors. What is the end result of the socialization process? How do adults, who of course are the ones who form the main line of communication to the children, think of males and females? Again, as with the children, I would like to discuss in some detail one study that I find particularly revealing, rather than attempt to review everything that has been done. A group of psychologists have developed what they call a sex stereotype questionnaire. This questionnaire consists of 122 items representing characteristics as masculine or as feminine. By giving these lists of characteristics to adults, they established first that there was high agreement as to what was masculine and feminine. In addition, they found that the stereotypically masculine qualities were rated by both males and females as more desirable. Examples of male-valued items included very aggressive, very independent, not at all emotional, very logical, very direct, very adventurous, very self-confident, and very ambitious. Examples of female-valued items included very talkative, very tactful, very gentle, very aware of the feelings of others, very religious, very quiet, and very strong need for security. In addition to finding out which items were more valued in general, they went on to test stereotypic views of psychologists and psychiatrists as to what constitutes mental health. Three matched groups of psychologists and psychiatrists, including both males and females, were given all 122 items, unlabeled and in random order. The first group was asked to check all the traits in the list that characterize a healthy adult male. The second group was asked to check all the traits that characterize a healthy adult female. The third group was given the list and asked to check the traits that characterize a healthy adult. The clinically healthy adult and the clinically healthy male were identical and totally different from the clinically healthy female. Here again, from the mental health professionals, we get the picture of femininity as a normal pathology. The double bind of the whole situation, of course, is that if a woman changes to become more like a healthy adult, this is seen as unfeminine and therefore sick. There just is not a healthy alternative for women in our society. Either you choose to do what's considered feminine, and then you're just a housewife, or else you choose to compete in the male world, and then you're masculine and aggressive. I think it is this double bind that is the most difficult thing for girls to handle in growing up. I think the socialization process with respect to sex types can be hard for both sexes. But for the boy, the direction of socialization is at least unidirectional, and the pressure to adopt masculine values comes early. Thus, by the time the boy is 2 or 3, the pressure begins to cut out the sissy and dependent behavior. This pressure continues, but for most, by early school age, it has eased off. This pressure is certainly not easy for some boys, and easing for many boys, and destructive to some. But for those to whom this pressure is not overwhelming, there are also rewards in the privileges and advantages that society offers males that make adopting male values easier. For the girl, the socialization to me does not seem so unidirectional. In her early years, masculine behavior is probably somewhat tolerated because it is seen, after all, as more valuable by society. Thus, being a tomboy and competitively striving, particularly in school, are rewarded and become a part of the way a girl thinks of herself. However, as she reaches adolescence, another set of social pressures becomes stronger. In many ways, these pressures are in conflict with the earlier ones. Now it is all right to test yourself and to do well, as long as it does not interfere with social and interpersonal success. To do well socially may conflict with individual strivings. To do well socially, some girls are forced to give up on themselves. But, on the other hand, to follow through on one's own desires may mean giving up social success and one's femininity. Again, this pressure is not equally destructive to all girls. I am not maintaining that the pressure, or perhaps crunch is a better word, is harder on girls than it is on boys. I would maintain that it is harder on some children than it is on others. But it does seem that the boys' socialization stands a better chance of being conflict-free, particularly after the first 5 years. And he has, at least, at the end of the road, many exciting and socially valued goals awaiting him. Before I finish, I would like to briefly discuss two typical sex role stereotype behaviors. The first is aggression. This is assumed to be a male character trait. What about small children? Are boys more aggressive than girls? If one considers only physical aggression, then sex differences begin to appear in children over 2 years of age. Up to two, the incidences of physical aggression are equal in the sexes. But after this, there seems to be considerably more pressure put on the girl to give up expression of aggression in physical terms. But does this mean that boys are more aggressive than girls? I don't know. What hasn't been studied are other forms of aggressive behavior, such as verbal aggression or passive aggressive behavior. Women may be as aggressive as men, but because they are more anxious and guilty about expressing it, they may use more subtle means of expressing it. Turning next to dependency, we examine a typical female characteristic. However, in addition to a feminine stereotype, dependency is also a natural state of infancy, both physical and emotional dependency. Thus, it is natural for both male and female infants to be dependent. What is needed is to strip away the most restricting and false parts of socialization, and to truly increase the value society places on, quote, typically feminine, unquote, qualities that are also good human qualities, such as tenderness, nurturance, and caring for other people. We have to allow women to become whatever they want and need to, and then perhaps we will know what feminine is. Perhaps there is no such thing as masculinity and femininity, but only humanity, with each person expressing his or her own variation of the range of human traits. Before we can know this, however, we must, as Shaw says, let the parrot out of the cage. I've chosen to close with the end of Shaw's parrot analogy. The only parrot a free-souled person can sympathize with is one that insists on being let out as the first condition of making itself agreeable. A selfish bird, you may say, one that puts its own gratification before that of the family which is so fond of it, before even the greatest happiness of the greatest number. One that, in aping the independent spirit of a man, has unparroted itself and become a creature that has neither the home-loving nature of a bird nor the strength and enterprise of a mastiff. All the same, you respect that parrot in spite of your conclusive reasoning, and if it persists, you will either have to let it out or kill it. Thank you.